When government confiscates preschoolers' lunches, bans private food vendors from school grounds, and funds 5 meals per day at local elementary schools, we simply must ask, again, should parents be allowed to feed their children?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 768th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Montreal who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Easton Allen on the boards. Hello, Easton.
Good morning, Michael.
Folks, welcome to part two of a two-part discussion on feeding our children. As a young journalist working for David Brinkley at NBC, I was taught to recognize the signs of a story, to read those signs, and then to use the information obtained from the signs to project where that story might be headed. I am now going to list some signs of a story currently in the news, and then invite you to join me to project where this story might be headed. So please listen carefully. First sign, childhood obesity is held up as a national crisis and a campaign is launched to provide a healthier school lunch for children. Second sign, a government inspector confiscates a preschooler's turkey and cheese sandwich and forces that child to eat chicken nuggets. Third sign, a California politician seeks to ban private school vendors for private food vendors from getting closer than one quarter mile away from public schools. And the fourth sign, the federal government funds 5 meals per day for children at a local elementary school. Now, if we pause to consider where these signs point, if we kind of line them up and look down the road to where they're headed, we kind of have to ask some interesting questions. They lead us to wonder, first, is the childhood obesity crisis too good to go to waste? Should parents be allowed to feed their children? What happens to the family if parents no longer feed their children? And finally, who will feed the children should our government go bankrupt? Here to help us find an answer, we have Chef Jamie Smith, food director, Santa Cruz, California, school system, right?
Yes, sir.
Welcome aboard. Hey, look who else we have here. We have Danny Keith. Let's see. Make sure. Danny, are you there?
I am.
Good. Danny Keith, you're the development director for Second Harvest Food Bank, right?
That's correct.
Good. And you're out of the office, and Jamie Smith is in the office today. Jamie Smith, supervise the food. We feed the children, right?
You determine
the menus and whatnot?
Determine the menus, help encourage the kids to choose healthy options and hopefully educate parents as well about quality food choices that they can make at home and during the day.
Good enough. Danny, Keith, you feed the children as well, right?
Second Harvest Food Bank, we service just over 55,000 people a month, with the better part of half of them being children.
Okay, so we're feeding the kids today. And we are also inviting you to participate out there today. The phone number is 831-479-1080 or foodchainradio@gmail.com. Or if you can join us on the forums at metrofarm.com. Lots of ways to participate. Let's start with the crisis itself. Is the childhood obesity crisis too good to go to waste? That's an interesting notion. Of course, we come to that question because that is one of the themes brought forth by the federal government in that, I believe it was Rahm Emanuel who said, never let a serious crisis go to waste. So is this crisis too good to go to waste? Let's start with you.
Well, Michael, I think that's an interesting perspective. I hadn't heard that one before, but it does go right along with some of the feelings I have about things. We do kind of captivate ourselves with media and social media about epidemics and catchwords like that are really scintillating and captivating for our, the general public.
We don't pay attention unless somebody comes up and slaps us on the face, right?
Yeah. So I think we do see a lot of kids a little bit larger than they're supposed to be at this age. It does have to do a lot with our technology. I mean, food technology, as you pointed out to me a couple of weeks ago, has basically led our overall technology race. The more easy access we have to food, the more ability we have to go out and do other things like,
right,
create iPhones and iPads and things like that. So,
in your schools, do you see fat kids?
I guess so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I do. I guess we ought to call it what we call it. Obesity, I think. I mean, just, fat sounds better to me than obese.
Obese, yeah.
I mean, it sounds like, there's something completely wrong with you. And I think that, we don't want kids to feel that way. We want to help them make better options and help them get outside and get some exercise and get off their PlayStations and Wiis and be all-around kids like kids are supposed to be.
Danny Keith, you're feeding children whose families essentially do not have the money to feed themselves. Are you seeing the obesity there as well?
Well, I mean, I think from the food bank's perspective, we're not only trying to fight malnutrition, but we're also trying to fight, the obesity issues that we have, especially with the working poor. When you can get a 2-liter bottle of soda for 69 cents and some fast food for a dollar, it's just not healthy choices for these families to be making. So Second Harvest Food Bank really likes to position itself, since we're the emergency food assistance program, to be able to provide the healthiest potential food that we could give these people. And, primarily we're distributing, fresh fruit and produce to the tune of 300,000 to 400,000 pounds a month right now.
Mm-hmm.
And while families do want to make good choices, I think sometimes, as Jamie stated, we've gotten off track with understanding, where our food comes from, what's healthy, what's
not
healthy.
We're talking about a parent problem here, aren't we? Are we not?
I think it's an education problem. I think we've just been...
Who are we educating here? Who's not doing the job of educating children about these choices here?
Well, I mean, I think the marketing of all these fast food joints and the food that's not healthy for us has circumvented people's thought processes to make wise decisions. So I think we've been duped partially, and I think also people haven't stop to think that, food is possibly the medicine that we need to be paying attention mm-hmm. to. And I think re-educating the parents as well as, providing that education to the children at their level, we know that if we can get in early with children, whatever it may be, whether it be education, whether it be teaching them about nutrition, whether it be teaching them compassion, that it tends to have staying power.
Right. So, well, why are kids getting fat, Jamie?
Well,
what are we doing? What are they being duped into eating?
Well,
the
empty calories phrase is actually one that I agree with. It's
Danny came up with a good one. Get this giant jug of soda pop for 69 cents, and
I don't even know how many grams of sugar in that.
Sugar,
and that translates
yeah.
into straight carb calories. Sugar isn't poison. It's just instant access to energy and easy to be used. So if you don't, it builds up in the body as fat. So it's pretty simple.
One thing I think we should
all remember is that nutrition science is about 30 years old, and I'm older than that. So when I was a kid, a TV dinner was like a technological marvel. It's a brand new thing that we're seeing here in nutrition science, and so it's still developing. We don't have even a multi-generational perspective on it yet.
Right, so let's talk about what happens to that big jug of soda pop when the kids eat it, drink it. I mean, you've got... How big is that, Danny? What did you describe there for 69 cents?
I believe it's 2-liter, bottles. I think that's probably about 4 servings, or maybe 6 servings, and probably averaging about 30 grams per serving. So it's probably close to a couple hundred grams of sugar in a bottle of soda.
Jamie, what happens when children drink how many grams of sugar?
Well, a regular size, a 16-ounce, I'm going to pick Sun-Kissed Soda, because we're not afraid of brand recognition on this show,
okay.
I hope. It has about 79 grams of sugar. 1 gram of sugar is a quarter of a teaspoon, so 1 teaspoon is 4 grams. I put about a half a teaspoon of sugar in my morning coffee. I cannot imagine consuming 20 teaspoons of sugar. But imagine putting 20 teaspoons of sugar directly into your mouth. That's what you're doing with a 16-ounce
So what happens to that sugar when a child drinks the soda pop and then sits down
and then sits down.
Sits down.
Perfect analogy.
Well, okay,
yeah.
The child drinks the soda pop and then sits down. What happens to
the
sugar?
Well, they've taken in a lot of sugar, and carbohydrates are the same thing in your body. They're the body's energy source. You know, other foods all do different
things. Got to have the energy, right?
You do. That's what, you know, carbs are all about. And sugar and carbs are basically the same thing. You know, high fructose corn syrup, sugar, fructose, all that stuff is the exact same thing when it hits your stomach. When the enzyme hits it, it turns into energy, or it wants to turn into energy. But when you sit directly after it, that energy is going nowhere.
And so?
It converts into fat.
There it is.
Stored energy, which is what fat is. So,
well,
okay, hold it. Danny, we're going to take a quick break. Got it? And we'll be right back. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. We're full of energy.
I know. I feel
lots
like standing
of sugar
up like
morning,
you, Michael.
Ready to go.
I'm sitting
and,
down right now.
We're talking food. We're talking parents. We're talking the government taking over the feeding of our children, where that's going to take us. You're invited to participate. We're talking with Danny Keith, who's the development director for Second Harvest Food Bank. Chef Jamie Smith, who's the food director for the city schools of Santa Cruz, California. And you, 831-479-1080. We will be right back. I am Michael Olson. This is the Food Chain Radio Program.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, pink slime. My goodness sakes. What on earth is pink slime? You know, that of course is in the news, and we're talking about feeding children, and we're talking about the government taking over the feeding of children, and what happens to parents in this equation. That's the subject of today, but let's focus on the school lunch for a moment. And rumor has it that we have been feeding our children pink slime. Now, what exactly is pink slime, Chef Jamie Smith?
Pink slime is probably a social media term for what the government calls lean, finely textured beef. I think that's right. LFTB. And what it is basically... It's not connective tissue. It's not bones. It's trimmings from meat. So when you go to the butcher shop and they trim up a steak for you and stuff like that, you know, these mechanical devices separate the fat from the meat and then remix them in proportions and push them through an extruder or a sieve.
It's kind of like hot dogs. It's how they made hot dogs.
It's just like hot dogs. Yeah, okay. It's just like chicken nuggets. It's just
Wait a minute. Chicken nuggets. Now, I've being raised on a farm, I think I must have butchered like 1,000 chickens in the course of my life.
Nice.
And in all of those 1,000 chickens and that I butchered and plucked the feathers off of, I never once could find any chicken nuggets. Now, what the heck are chicken nuggets?
Chicken nuggets are the same thing. They're formed pieces of chicken that that don't have the primal cut use, such as the breast, the thigh, the leg, the wing.
You know, it's kind of like white slime instead of pink slime.
Yeah, it's light pink.
Okay. All right.
So, you know, let me just make a quick analogy. When I was in cooking school, I went to a French cooking school, and we used to make things called pâté. And this is where I think sometimes we've lost perspective. I am not a proponent of pink slime because it's just too industrial for me, but it isn't a lot different than when I was learning how to make pâté manually without the use of a machine, with a meat grinder that we would chill in the refrigerator to make sure we keep everything safe, with bowls of... you know, pressed meat set in a bowl of ice and then formed into a shape like a galantine or a ballotine. I know that sounds crazy, But before electricity, the most difficult piece of charcuterie to make was bologna, believe it or not, because it was so smooth and finely textured, it was considered a marvel of charcuterie before electricity. Now we see bologna as...
something
I mean,
else.
Think about what the word actually even means. That's bologna, as if that's garbage. And
okay.
So it's a... We change over time.
So now we have a situation, we're faced with a situation in which a parent packs her child, a preschooler, a lunch of a turkey and cheese sandwich, I think a banana, some apple juice, and a little bag of potato chips, and sends the child to school. And then a food inspector says, just a minute here, young person, let me look into your lunch bag. And the federal inspector looks into the lunch bag and, oh my God, you have a turkey and cheese sandwich. And they confiscate that turkey and cheese sandwich and force the child to eat chicken nuggets. Now, I've considered the relative merits of what I know about food. I'm thinking that child got shortchanged in nutritionally speaking. As a food person, what do you think?
I have to admit, I can't get my mind around the fact that that actually happened that way. And I believe that it probably is a little bit blown out of proportion.
Everything is hard to imagine.
But perhaps we're talking about Wonder Bread, mayonnaise. The idea, I believe, behind it was that there was not enough protein in the lunch to qualify for a lunch. It's my understanding that the federal government should not
be intruding. If you were to look at the protein content of the turkey sandwich and compare that with the protein of the chicken nuggets, there was almost half again more protein in the turkey sandwich than in the chicken nugget.
And I think that, you know, that chicken nuggets may have all the protein and vitamins in it that the government says it is, but due to the form and the process and the way the things are bound and all the agents that are used to keep it together, there's no way your body absorbs it. So I think the turkey sandwich clearly was healthier. I mean, that's a huge mistake for whoever did it. I know that they were going above and beyond trying to do the right thing, I would believe. I can't imagine.
Well, and that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
We're talking about trying to do the right thing. But in trying to do the right thing, do we always do the right thing? And I'm thinking when you take a lunch away from a child, you're not only, you know, depriving that child of that lunch, but you're also doing something to how that child sees their parent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a grave mistake for sure. And, you know, USDA has been scrambling with its PR team to fix that one and certainly trying to educate all of its people in the field.
Danny Keith? Are you there, Danny?
I think in relation to that episode, I would say that, you know, we're all humans. And, you know, obviously that human made a really bad decision to decide to, you know, take a child's lunch and make them eat the chicken nuggets. But I also do believe that, you know, and Jamie and I have talked about this, that, you know, if we can provide the healthiest potential opportunity for food, whether it's government funded, whether it's the food bank that provides it, whether it's the cafeteria or whether it's the parent, you know, it goes back to educating the person that's consuming the food. I really believe that that's where we are.
And
when
it's a child that's eating that food, if you have a preschooler, okay, that's eating the food, who should be in charge of educating the child?
Well, ultimately, I believe the parent's responsibility. Wow. I mean, it should be first and foremost. It's a really tricky question to answer because a lot of parents didn't get the right education around what food to be eating. I mean, it's like, I believe we do have multi-generational disconnect when it comes to what food is proper. I mean, I oftentimes talk with people and they're more aware of the gasoline they put in their car than they are the food they put in their body. So I think, you know, if the parents are struggling to maybe provide the proper direction for that child, then, I mean, as a second, you know, position, it wouldn't be bad for the school systems to be able to provide that guidance.
Okay, fair enough. What about forcing private food vendors to stay at least one quarter mile away from school? Is it true that private food vendors are no good? Jamie Smith?
No, not all of them, of course. We have some fantastic, you know, the gourmet truck food scene is going viral in San Francisco and L.A., and we have, you know, a couple of good ones right here in Santa Cruz, and unclear whether or not they would be included. I mean, I don't know how we can, you know, start to put regulations on them about what they serve and how they can be.
Well, are we not kind of forced then to have? It's kind of the same situation. The child has a choice between a 2-liter bottle of soda pop and a glass of water, and you know, somehow the child has to know which private food vendor is good, or do we legislate that all to government? Do we make that a responsibility of government to figure out which one should be allowed, or should none of them be allowed? Danny, what do you think?
Well, I mean, that bill recently got taken off the table for lack of votes, but, you know, I've often, on that method, disagree. I think that, you know, you could park them 1,000 feet away, and the kids, if they're desiring...
Maybe they get some exercise then, right?
I know, I like that. At least I have to walk away to get it.
All right.
They're going to still pursue the opportunity. I think it still goes back to educating the kids. I mean, I oftentimes speak in schools, and I'll ask the kids, you know, are you eating hot Cheetos? And they raise their hands, and I just tell them, like, you're going to die. That's not good food for you. You know, you need to eat healthy food, you know? And so they need, you know, I think, you know, I don't believe that we should be making laws. I mean, we see it all the time with drug addiction. We make laws against drugs, but people still pursue them. So I think it's an education. I'm going to stick to that kernel of information mm-hmm. that people need to educate themselves. And if the kids aren't getting that from the parents, and somebody, you know, some institution or some person needs to step in.
Okay. And then we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to really get into this issue of how much the government is feeding at schools right now. Saw an article in the paper talking about your school system, Jamie, wherein the government is now feeding our children 5 meals a day at school. My goodness.
They're only paying for 4. I'm covering one of them.
Okay. This is the food chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking food and who should feed our children. Should it be the parents? Should it be government? What happens if the government takes over feeding our children and then goes flat broke? Who will feed the children then? This is the food chain. I am Michael Olson, your host for the hour. Today we're talking with Jamie Smith, City Schools Food Director, Santa Cruz, California, Danny Keith, Development Director, Second Harvest Food Bank, and you, right back. Well, what do you think out there? Is the childhood obesity crisis too good to go to waste? Should parents be allowed to feed their children? What happens to the family if parents no longer feed their children? And hey, if the government does take over feeding our children, who will feed the children when our government goes bankrupt? Just some questions we're playing with today right here on the Food Chain Radio program. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. We've got Danny Keith, the Second Harvest Food Bank. We have Chef Jamie Smith, who's the food director for the Santa Cruz, California City School System. And, of course, we have you. You're invited to participate if you'd like to chip in with questions and comments. We're at 831-479-1080, or you can go to foodchainradio@gmail.com, or you can go to the forums at metrofarm.com. Lots of ways to participate. But, hey, today we're feeding our children 5 meals a day in the public schools. Oh, my goodness. I'm thinking back to when I was a kid in school. I guess we're talking prehistoric times now. But it certainly wasn't the case. I don't even think I would think that was before they fed kids in city schools. 5 meals a day, Chef Jamie Smith, what's going on?
Well, I don't think you were quite that old. We did start the National School Lunch Program in the 40s. So,
I guess I missed out.
Yeah, then. So we've been...
I was up in Montana, and that was... at the end of the food chain, I guess.
Yeah. But we are offering students the opportunity to take advantage of our meal program at 5 different times during the day.
Why 5, though? I mean...
Because kids have, you know, short-term appetites, you know, just mm-hmm. like they have short-term memory loss, they have short-term appetites, short attention spans. You know, when they show up late for school and they haven't had breakfast, we give them the opportunity to get it at the mid-morning break instead of going out to recess, you know, and a hungry kid that runs out to recess and comes back in to try and learn is not going to be focused, isn't going to have attention spans that do anything to
benefit
right. them. If kids get to school early because the parents work over the hill or have a commute, if they get there at 7 7:30, we give them the opportunity to have breakfast then. So we're giving them two opportunities for breakfast. We always serve a great lunch with salad bars and, you know, local produce, apples from Gizditch Ranch. And, you know, we have great opportunities for them to get a lunch. That's already built in. Then we have aftercare programs for students that have supplemental instructional opportunities. You know, we have a great program called ACES that's trying to help a first generation of students become college bound. And, you know, as soon as my kids get home from school, they're starving. I'm starving.
Well, yeah, that much I remember about school. As soon as they got home, I was hungry as all
heck. Of course. So, you know, kids basically eat, you know, five little meals
a day. And quite frankly, we all probably should when it gets right down to it,
that's
right?
That's what they say. You should eat a bunch of, you know, light meals throughout the day.
Yeah, and have a continuing source of protein so that your body has a continuing source of things to burn. But that being the case, why would parents feed their children if schools are feeding them five meals a day?
I do hope that parents will continue to feed their kids, because that's a quality family time that I think is often lost. And we've all seen the statistics that, 30% of families actually sit down and have dinner every night, or maybe even less. I can't remember the percentage, but it's abysmally low. And that's a really, you know, great quality family time. But a lot of families don't have time for that these days, with difficult work schedules and both parents working. And when they don't, quality time needs to be had for families. And if we can provide them, you know, the opportunity to give them nutritional assistance that'll get the kids through the day, and they can come home and play catch in the backyard with dad, that's a great deal. Mm-hmm. You know, that's worth every penny. That's worth its weight in gold. Quality family time is great, whether it's around a meal or whether it's around something that they do in the after school hours. So, it's not meant to take away.
It's not meant to take away from the
family.
Not
at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
But does it?
You know, I couldn't tell you. You know, to every family, it provides a different opportunity. To families that say, hey, we're free to, you know, go out and do something on our own, like go see a movie and eat a bunch of junk food, well, that's not our goal for sure. So in these after-school programs where we do after-school snacks and we feed the kids what's called a supper through the Child and Adult Care Food Program that's sponsored by the USDA, we provide nutrition education, and in all of our programs, we're mandated to provide nutrition education to kids. We aren't just handing out free food. We are providing nutrition education. Second Harvest Food Bank has taken on, you know, a fantastic nutrition education program called Passion for Produce. We're going to roll that out at Galt Elementary School here, and it's fantastic.
Right. Okay, speaking of Passion for Produce, Danny Keith, you must have a passion for this. Look, we're talking about, I guess, supplanting the family. Are we not?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, if it's funny, you know, you look at, you know, you work for Google and Google has free food for everybody to eat all day long and nobody's kind of worried about that. But the school systems, because they have the element of government, all of a sudden it's this big scary thing. But to speak about Passion for Produce, you know, that was a program that was started a couple years ago at a Second Harvest Food Bank with the realization that the people that we're servicing, this is truly the last line of defense for them as when it comes to nutrition. And, you know, the food bank has since in the last 3 years has, you know, we're turning away soda donations. We're turning away high fructose corn syrup donations. We're trying to focus on healthy food. And so this Passion for Produce program has been developed to create like a peer level education where we train 12 people, then they train 12 people, and it's an owned environment of the people that are actually participating. It's much likelier for me to buy or to be influenced by Jamie Smith telling me something to do rather than getting it from a third-party stream. So the goal here is to use the community to educate the community, and it will go further. And since the campaign or since the program's been initiated, we've graduated, and we do graduate these people through a process of over 200 different Passion for Produce ambassadors.
You know, Michael, you said, are we supplanting the family? I got to take that away. I think we're planting the family again.
All right, good.
You know, over this over these 30 years of food technology, we just didn't get it. You know, now we're starting to get it, but social media wants results and wants inflammatory stuff to happen right now, and it doesn't work like that.
Okay, good. Now, what do you mean? Well, take me back 30 years, and what have we learned? I mean, 30 years ago, we learned how to essentially take food off the farm and reprocess it. You know, the great skill we learned 30 years ago was how to take cheap food or raw materials that didn't cost very much, like a bushel of corn, and turned it into some very expensive foods, like soda pop. You know, that
well, they're expensive because they're expensive on our bodies.
Yes,
right. It, you know, it all started with the initial commodities, things that could be siloed, and that was corn and rice and cotton, and I can't remember. There was five initial commodities, but they were just things that you could put in a silo. But it was all about food preservation techniques. And 30 years ago, you know, the TV dinner, whenever it came out, whether it was astronaut food or whatever, that was amazing technology. That was the jet
Tang
comes to life, you know, Tang. You know, that was kind of our initial food revolution, and we were captivated by that. You know, and we really want our produce to look like it should on the jet.
And we could make cheap food.
And we could make tons of cheap food out of byproducts. And that's driven by old food technology where we wanted to get the most out of something. You know,
but
I was
then we're coming to grips with that. We're going to have to take a quick break. But when we come back, I'd like to talk about how we're coming to grips with that and the implications of our coming to grips with that on the American family, on moms and dads, and their relationship to their children. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Danny Keith, Second Harvest Food Bank, Chef Jamie Smith, Santa Cruz Public Schools, and you, 831-479-1080. What do you think the place will be for parents should government or anybody else take over the feeding of their children? What use will there be for parents? What do you think? Give us a ring. Tune in. Hey, we're back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. We're talking about feeding our children. Who should feed our children? Should we take the parents out of that equation of feeding our children? What do you think, folks? 831-479-1080. We've got Chef Jamie Smith here. We've got Danny Keith, Second Harvest Food Bank, and you, 831-479-1080. 30 years ago, we learned how to process raw commodities into, I don't know, food-ready products. You know, just open the package and there it is. Tangs, instant Tang. And yet you say we're coming to grips with this technology because actually it was that technology that kind of led us right down the wrong road, did it not? When it got down to it. And that's why we have this food crisis where we look at our school children and we see them fat. And it's because the food that we're feeding them does not allow them to grow up strong and makes them grow up fat.
Well, you know, kids used to work on their, you know, family farms or in their, you know, their parents, you know, homes or whatever in 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago. So they had a lot more exercise, shall we say. They walked to school. You know, we have a much more sedentary lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obesity used to be the luxury of the rich. And now it's the plague of the poor. And, you know, it has to do with availability of food. You know, wealthier people have greater access to time for exercise, like yoga class, and high-quality foods, you know, protein and nutrition supplements that they can get at, you know, expensive markets like Whole Foods. So
You're talking about people from poorer families who are incredibly educated with respect to this stuff.
Yeah, I at our most recent Passion for Produce Nutrition Ambassador training, I literally spoke for about 7 seconds because the group of people that we had assembled to lead this program at our next program at Galt Elementary School, almost every one of them had a member of their family that was stricken by a food or nutrition-related medical condition, primarily diabetes, and their depth of knowledge blew me away. Absolutely. They knew all the things that I assumed were only the luxury of the rich. And, you know, it was incredible. And when you talk about supplanting the family and feeding our kids, it's going to be communities that feed our kids.
It takes a village?
It does. It truly does. Okay. I mean, remember Stone Soup, my favorite story.
Go ahead, tell us.
Well, if you don't know the story Stone Soup, it's one that's worth looking up. A passerby comes through a village with a stone and starts musing about how great it would be if he just had some onions and some carrots and some potatoes and a pot and a little fire and maybe some water to cook it. And, you know, maybe someone has a piece of steak. Oh, I remember this great soup I had with steak. And all of a sudden, the community has come together and created a wonderful meal for the entire village. And it changed the culture and the face of the village from one of fear and looking out their pulled curtains at night and, you know, letting something wrong outside just pass them by, to getting involved with their neighbors and getting involved with their community. And that's what Passion for Produce is going to do for our community here in Santa Cruz. And it's what I think this food revolution is going to do for communities around the country and the world.
Is that your aim, Danny?
Well, I think Second Harvest truly, it's an inversely related business. You know, as people's needs go up, so does our demand, and vice versa. So, yeah, I mean, I think 110%, you know, Second Harvest is dedicated to making sure that the people that need the food the most are going to get the most healthiest alternatives. And, you know, I think, again, backfilling that with education, like Jamie and I have been talking about this Passion for Produce program, it just strengthens our reach into the community. And just because people are in the worst times of their lives does not mean that some of these people are the most intelligent people I've met at times. So yes. I mean, I think to answer your question succinctly, yes, we are focused on that.
Okay, then the problem seems to be that some children just lack in the knowledge of what to eat, and furthermore don't have access to the food that they need to eat. And so,
fair enough? I would disagree with that.
Okay, go ahead, disagree.
I think we have access to foods. I think people make choices. You know, I think, we're allowing the marketing of these foods that are poisoning our population, both in obesity and diabetes and other early onset health crises that we're facing. You know, we've got to get back to, you know, why can't broccoli be 69 cents? Why do sodas have to be so cheap? I mean, but what my point is, it's not being marketed like that. We're buying into this marketing of, you know, McDonald's and fast food.
So are you suggesting Danny, are you suggesting that government should step in then and regulate the marketing of who can say what about what?
No, please.
No, don't. I think more government intervention is not the answer. I think, you know, people have to embrace and become educated.
All right, then that takes us back to the starting point here, which is, to me, it has to be the family, and it has to be the parents that are taking these young children and giving them the knowledge that they need to stand up to these bad choices. And so I ask, what is going to happen if the parents are removed from this equation? Now, I'm not saying that you guys are trying to do that. I'm just looking at the signs, and they seem to be pointed in that direction. They seem to be pointed toward, down the road toward, well, families are no longer taking care of children, so government is going to step in and take charge. And if that is the case, what then happens to the parents? What happens to the family? And Lordy knows what happens when the government goes bankrupt and can no longer feed everybody. So when we come back, I'd like to ask both of you, where should the parents be in this equation, and how can they hold on to that position? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Today we're talking food, we're talking families, we're talking children. And we're talking with Danny Keith from Second Harvest Food Bank. We're talking with Chef Jamie Smith, City Schools Food Director, Santa Cruz, California. We will be right back to conclude. Okay, a couple minutes left. Big question on the table. So we get rid of the family, I guess. Take the parents out of the equation. We feed the children at school. We feed them wherever we can because the parents are no longer giving the children enough information they need to grow up into the world. But then what happens to the family when the parents are no longer seen by the children as a source of that kind of knowledge? What happens to the children when they go out into the world without parents? What happens to the children when the government no longer can borrow enough money to feed them? These are the questions that I'm led to ask when looking at the signs I see in the news. So maybe I'm just way out of line here. Chef Jamie Smith, what should be the role of parents in this equation? And if so, how can we keep them in that role?
Well, we give them opportunities to be parents. When you say, you know, what's going to happen to the family, I think Danny and I would say there isn't just one family. You know, we are offering services to thousands of families daily. And every family is different. You know, some families only have one parent. Some families have two working parents. Some families have parents working two or three jobs. Everyone is different. So what happens to the family is an open-ended question that we're not going to solve on here. But when you start putting families together, like at Second Harvest Food Bank, mm-hmm. where groups come together for nutrition education, where families meet their kids all together at school and they pick up their kids, or they come to, you know, an after-school program where we're serving kids fresh quality foods and giving them nutrition education, they come together around a common, theme or motivational thing for them, and then they take it home. So, these things are not about giving out handouts so that families can go off and go to the boardwalk and do whatever they want to do. It's about coming together around food, which has always been the meeting place for great revolution, whether it's, you know, cultural revolution or a big business deal or whatever it is. We've always come to the table. That's what that phrase means. Come to the table is about coming to the dinner table, you know, when we're coming together. So,
Danny Keith, what do you think?
Well, I think we're definitely in a period of reengineering. I mean, there's I have a 4-year-old, and we watch WALL-E. And if you see WALL-E, you know, you see these people floating on these little hovercrafts, and basically we're trying to outsmart ourselves to not have to do any physical labor. But the problem is that we have to get back to basics. We have to reengineer people's thought processes to understand that eating healthy will make them have more productive days, will give them more time with their family, will put them in better moods.
And do you think the parents should be involved in that?
Absolutely. I think the parents are, you know, culpable in this whole process. They need to be the ones that are instigating this education piece and supporting that. No matter if it's coming from below through the kids' school system, whether it's coming through a side organization such as Second Harvest Food Bank and engineering, you know, the Passion for Produce program, or whether they're learning it head on by going to their own local farmers markets. People have to embrace, you know, eating locally and eating well and realizing that what they're putting in their body, you know, is definitely going to exponentially affect their health down the road.
Can you see the difference between that, the mind of a healthy child and the mind of a malnourished child, Jamie Smith?
Folks, remember, your body is actually smarter than your mind. It is. You know, when your body is converting calories into fat, it thinks you're going to be going on a 100-year walk. It's like you must be trying to store up energy for something. Our bodies are smarter than our minds, and we have to get our minds to catch up with our bodies.
Chef Jamie Smith, Danny Keith, thank you both for joining us today on The Food Chain. Thank you out there for joining us as well. You can always join us with your comments and questions on the forums at metrofarm.com. Love to have you there. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on The Food Chain with Michael Olson. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.